Hello, it's Friday, June the 26th. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, President Obama's flagship climate change bill is put to the vote.
This bill isn't what Barack Obama promised, but there seems to be a broad consensus here in Washington that it is the best that can be hoped for at this moment in time.
First, the MPs, now BBC executives, face scrutiny over their expenses.
So we're going to release information regularly about the pay and about the expenses, line-by-line expenses, so people can see exactly what's been spent by all the key decision-makers in the BBC.
Plus, the government steps up its strategy to protect itself from cyber attacks.
Citizens are in danger of being victims of organised crime. There are potentially terrorist attacks on our country. So we're setting up the strategic unit to look at cyber security.
First, a news update and a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
Michael Jackson has died at the age of 50. The singer suffered a heart attack at his home in Los Angeles and was rushed to hospital. But he didn't regain consciousness and doctors were unable to revive him. His brother Jermaine has been talking to reporters and telling them what the family knew.
My brother, the legendary king of pop, Michael Jackson, passed away on Thursday, June 25th, 2009 at 2:26 p.m. It is believed he suffered cardiac arrest in his home. However, the cause of his death is unknown until results of the autopsy are known. His personal physician, who was with him at the time, attempted to resuscitate my brother, as did the paramedics who transported him to Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center.
Michael Jackson, the self-proclaimed King of Pop, sold more than 750 million albums worldwide and won 13 Grammy Awards. Fans have gathered to mourn him from Australia and Japan to South America. At his childhood home in Indiana, they've left teddy bears and roses. In New York, the campaigner, the Reverend Al Sharpton, hailed him as a fighter for black civil rights.
We fought together. I watched him do shows. I headed Community Affairs for his victory tour. I watched him sell stadiums out. Michael Jackson made culture accept a person of color way before Tiger Woods, way before Oprah Winfrey, way before Barack Obama. And no controversy will erase the historic impact.
Al Sharpton speaking about the death of Michael Jackson. Other news now, 1 in 10 deaths in Europe can be attributed to drinking alcohol. A report published in the medical journal The Lancet also shows alcohol accounts for 1 in 25 deaths across the world as a whole. The proportion of men suffering alcohol-related deaths was much higher at 1 in 5 in Europe. There's been an agreement in the dispute at power stations that sparked a strike by several thousand construction workers across Britain. The agreement will be put to workers today. It's believed to reinstate 650 who were sacked at the Total Oil refinery in Lincolnshire. It's the picture of actress Farrah Fawcett that gets on several front pages of the papers this morning. She died yesterday at the age of 62, best known for her part in the TV series Charlie's Angels. The Mirror headline reads, "Back with the Angels," and The Guardian says she'd been suffering from cancer since 2006. The Guardian leads with its exclusive story about a major government change in education policy. Labour to junk Blair's flagship school reform, it writes, explained that next week the government will end the centralised control of schools and give power back to head teachers. Otherwise, the main story is Andy Murray's second round win at Wimbledon. The Independent says he had his opponent seeing stars, and the Mail calls him Andy Hurry because of the speed at which he won his three sets. The other papers go for the publication of BBC expenses and top salaries. The Real World versus Planet BBC is the Mail headline. It's 27 BBC bosses earn more than the Prime Minister in the Telegraph. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
First, when President Obama arrived at the White House back in January, he made some pretty big promises to the international community on climate change. Departing from President Bush's stance, Obama promised a new chapter in climate leadership, and today could see him deliver a vote passing plans to take action on cutting carbon emissions. Our US environment correspondent, Suzanne Goldenberg, is in Washington. She explains what's in the bill before Congress.
At the heart of this sort of sweeping 1,200-page bill that is expected to be put to a vote today is a cap-and-trade system so that the U.S. would commit to cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 17% from 2005 levels in 2020 and eventually to more than 80% by 2050. This is on its own much less than what Europe has signed on for. It's, you know, only a fraction of a few percentage points. But environmentalists say it's important to look at the other measures of this very sweeping bill. There's energy efficiency, new building codes, $7 billion clean energy bank, and that all these measures put together in addition to the cap and trade system are going to move America off fossil fuels and towards a clean energy future.
The president, President Obama, has had a lot of opposition, hasn't he? Even Democratic opposition, but also the Republicans saying that he plans a hidden energy tax. Has this led to a watered-down version of his promises?
This bill isn't what Barack Obama promised, and it's not what Democrats had promised, and it's not what environmentalists wanted. But there seems to be a broad consensus here in Washington that it is the best that can be hoped for at this moment in time, and that, you know, there are other avenues available still for America to begin making the much deeper cuts in greenhouse gas emissions that are required to sort of prevent the worst impacts of climate change in the future.
You mentioned before that the cap and trade element of the package isn't as impressive as the European ones. How do the other parts of the package compare to European promises?
That's where this bill is believed to be stronger because of its broad reach and because of the other mechanisms that are available to the federal government. The number of different industries covered in this agreement is broader than in Europe. It's going to apply to 85% of emissions in the U.S., so that's encouraging. There's also measures being taken to reduce separately that will reduce, you know, global warming pollution from cars. That's really important. There's another element of the bill that is going to make it, that's going to compel states to get a larger share of their electricity from wind and from solar. There's money available to encourage the development of those sources of energy, to encourage a smart grid, to spur more research into clean coal technology. So that these package of measures, together with other things that the Obama administration has done to date, like, you know, the green jobs and its $787 billion economic recovery plan. The idea is that if you look at all these things together, then it's quite an impressive, set of measures.
Apologies for the poor quality of that phone line. That's Suzanne Goldenberg in Washington. We stay with climate change now. On the 100th anniversary of the Science Museum in London, James Randerson, editor of the Guardian Environment website, has been speaking to Chris Rapley, its director. James started by asking whether Mr. Rapley was optimistic about whether or not we are able to avoid serious climate change.
I think there are reasons for optimism and pessimism, which is almost the political answer, isn't it? The reasons for optimism are that I'm convinced that there are both technical and social solutions out there that if we marshalled ourselves, we could implement and we could sustain the energy supply that keeps modern life going and decarbonise it sufficiently that it would be sustainable over the long term. What worries me is that the evidence up to now, at least, is that the nose of the oil tanker is continuing to go in the wrong direction. That is, we've got to reach our peak of annual emissions very soon, because if we don't, the latest calculations show that the rate then at which we would have to reduce emissions becomes impractical. By anybody's optimistic standards. So although I get very uncomfortable when people say, you know, there's 100 months to save the planet, or at least save humanity and civilization, because that sounds a bit shrill and almost sort of silly, nevertheless, there's a grain of truth, more than a grain of truth, in the fact that it is getting increasingly urgent that we take real action. So when I see government people and business, you know, citizens' movements, that gives me reason for optimism. My role at the Science Museum tells me that, human ingenuity knows almost no bounds. So that fills me with optimism. But it's not until I see the nose of the oil tanker beginning to turn that I shall begin to sleep a little more comfortably at night. thinking about the world that my children and grandchildren will be confronted with.
A few sort of voices out there in the last sort of year or so have been starting to say, well, you know, this kind of approach of talking about costs and kind of almost scaring people into trying to make action happen is not going to be successful. I'm not suggesting that that's your approach, but the one that some campaigners use. I'm thinking about people like Anthony Giddens and Nicholas Stern, who say we should have a kind of positive, aspirational view of the future. Do you think that's starting to emerge and people are starting to grasp onto that?
Yes, I think so. I think there's a recognition that the approaches that have been taken so far have essentially reached their limit, because, you know, the percentage of people who take this seriously and are active, the people who take it seriously and are not active, and the people who still deny that it's an issue, have been more or less constant for a few years now. So it's clear that whatever means of communicating the issue, we need to rethink. And I think you've got to offer people a positive vision of the future, because, you know, if you offer a kind of cold grey hair shirt, miserable vision of the future, nobody's going to be motivated to pursue that. So at the Science Museum, with our new exhibit there, one of the key facets of that will be a vision of the future where we've got it right. Actually, the opposite of the view presented by The Age of Stupid, which I think is a great film and very thought-provoking, very valuable, but essentially the antithesis of that, you know, showing the Age of Sensible, you know, how we did it right and where we can be.
People talk about 2 degrees warming on pre-industrial levels being the sort of threshold at which dangerous climate change kicks in. Do you think we have any chance of staying below that, and do you have any sense of where we might end up getting to if we're not going to hit that?
There are many scientists who are arguing now that even 2 degrees has a higher degree of risk than we appreciated a few years ago, and so all the more reason for what recently has been called the fierce urgency of now. You know, this is not something for the long term. I mean, obviously it affects the long term, but we do need to act now, and the Copenhagen conference provides an opportunity to get international instruments in place which give us hope for the future.
As part of the Science Museum's 100th anniversary today, for those who are able to visit, there is a 3-day public birthday party with a new centenary trail plus 2 new exhibitions. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, as Mousavi defies pressure to concede the Iranian elections, follow the latest from Tehran at guardian.co.uk/Iran. A US church releases a video in which it claims a teenager is exorcised of his homosexuality. guardian.co.uk/world. News, reviews, comment and blogs from this year's Glastonbury at guardian.co.uk/music, plus Andy Murray at Wimbledon. That's at guardian.co.uk/sport. To matters of security now, in particular, cyber security, which Gordon Brown has turned his attention to. In the Prime Minister's words, we have to secure our position in cyberspace. To do this, he has ordered GCHQ, the government's electronic spy centre, to step up operations against the increasing number of cyber attacks and update the national security strategy. The Guardian's security editor, Richard Norton Taylor, tells us why the Prime Minister is talking about this now.
Yeah, well, I think the government wants desperately to link something sort of freshish or sounding specific in its new national security strategy paper, which is a year after the first one. And it was struggling, to be honest, to get something sort of meaty to put into this 100-page document. They thought it was timely to put something about cyberspace and the cyber warfare. I'd been building up to draw up some sort of evidence about this, although I have to say not many specifics in it.
Well, I mean, do we know who it is that is threatening cyber warfare on the British government? Is it the Chinese, the Russians?
The head of the security service, MI5, said earlier this year, Jonathan Evans said earlier this year, that the Chinese and the Russians, he singled out those two countries, were trying to attack British states, state government, Whitehall Department's computer systems. And indeed, we reported, and officials confirmed to us a couple of years ago, the Chinese had successfully attacked one or two Whitehall Department's computer systems, including the foreign offices.
This was in 2006, wasn't it?
2006 and 2007, yeah.
Now, when you use the word successful, what does that mean?
Well, exactly.
What did they obtain?
Well, I think nothing key. You see, Lord West, who's the Minister of State responsible for security, told some of us today that there's no key, there's no evidence of any key data being lost from any government department. And then he was very coy about mentioning figures, actually, or what they know, what the security intelligence agencies in Britain know. And he said no key data has been lost. And he said that, for example, BT report 1,000 kind of attacks every day. Then I asked what kind of attacks. They're not very important. Most of them are minor ones. So the government, on the one hand, I think, wants to actually alert people, or generally, in a genuine way, I suppose, especially critical national, you know, banking systems and Whitehall departments, alert them to the threat, which is presumably increasing, but doesn't actually say specifically what the threat is, the nature of the threat, or how far it's worsening.
With all this vague rhetoric, are they more specific on how much this is going to cost us?
No, they don't even say that, because it's part of the what they call a single secret vote, which covers the whole budgets of GCHQ, MI5 and MI6, which and the actual total vote is, you know, billion plus, which is not a secret, but any individual program, the cost of any individual program under that, you know, figure is kept quiet. Hundreds of millions of pounds, that's all they will say. And a lot of it's attached to GCHQ in Cheltenham.
Now, the government and computer systems haven't been the best of bedfellows over the years, whether it be nationally or internationally. You know, how do we know this is going to work?
Well, as you're right. The government, Whitehall civil servants, do not seem to understand how new technology, high tech, and computer systems work, and they've had to bring in, as we know, private sector companies. I suppose pretty obviously they have had to, but they haven't been able to manage those systems properly, and waste a hell of money. They don't know what to ask for. They keep on changing the specifics of what programs they want. Ministry of Defence and the intelligence services have to say, in particular, which is rather worrying. Anyway, terrorists, they say have the intent to try and indulge in cyber warfare, but they haven't got the capability to do it yet. Lord West says the British are probably less vulnerable than the Americans. We know the Americans are quite vulnerable, partly because they started a lot of internet links with government departments, including the military, very early on. And so there's a rather sort of mixed message going on. We've got to do something. There's a potential threat. What is the actual threat? Then they start getting vague about it.
The Guardian's security editor, Richard Norton Taylor. Still to come on today's podcast, we hear from the international stars of the new movie from Mexico, Rudo y Cursi. That is Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna.
Yeah, we got together again with Alfonso and Carlos, you know, the Cuarón brothers. Carlos directed this film. He wrote Tito Mama también. So it's kind of the same team, family reunion.
Next, following a certain sense of schadenfreude across the media over the fiasco surrounding MPs' expenses, the BBC is now facing what could be a similar backlash over its expenses. It's making available the salaries and line-by-line expenses for the 10 executive directors, plus detailed expenses and salaries of a further 100 of the highest earners and decision-makers, plus how much is spent on talent, though that figure is a total and not a breakdown of how much certain stars are trousering. Media Guardian's Stephen Brook has taken his fine tooth comb to the details for us. Let's start with the BBC Director General Mark Thompson and his penchant for business lunches.
You could argue that is his job, because he has to meet a lot of executives. He has to meet a lot of executives within the BBC, without the BBC. He's also got to massage the talent. The headline for him, though, really, is that it was more than £2,000 that was spent flying his family back from their summer holiday when the Saxgate affair, the big fuss over Jonathan Ross, kicked off. And in some ways, that's a legitimate expense, because obviously he was on holidays, he had to interrupt his holidays, but it's going to look quite odd to some people. I think what you can say about a lot of these expenses is that within the media industry, they're not actually that high, and that if we had access to expenses at, say, ITV or Sky, they'd probably be a lot more. But it's our money, it's the licence fee money that is being used to pay for this. And so that's where the BBC is on dangerous ground with some of the claims.
But also he has an office, doesn't he? Why doesn't he have his meetings in the office? Why does it have to be at the swanky Langham or somewhere like that?
It's interesting, isn't it? And I think there's a bit of a media and showbiz tradition here, because there are, I think, about four restaurants at Television Centre where a lot of the BBC is based. But clearly, if you've got to entertain Terry Wogan or Bruce Forsyth, you're going to go to a different location to do that. It's going to be interesting to see whether the public thinks that's just how the game is played and that's run-of-the-mill, or whether they think in these tough times that is a bit of largesse.
The issue of talent is also mentioned. It makes you dread to think what the talent wage bill is.
Yes, and this has been a big problem for the BBC over the past year, particularly with Jonathan Ross, because he earns, I think his contract was about £16.9 million over 3 years, which people thought was way too much. So the BBC is under pressure to, and has said publicly that it's going to, every time a contract comes up for negotiation, BBC stars are going to have to deal with less money. We're not going to find out how much individual stars have been earning, although there have been a lot of leaks in the past, which has given us some indication. But the total talent bill that the BBC forks out will be released down the track, and it's going to be huge.
And how damaging is this information out now and the information that we will hear later? How damaging is that going to be for the BBC?
Well, it comes on top of the MP's expenses, and I think that in some ways the BBC is in a better position than the MPs because it doesn't look like they've been feathering their own nests to quite the outrageous extent that a lot of MPs have been. Also, I think we can see that a lot of these expenses are in their line of duty, even though some of them look outrageous or some of them, in fact, look very minor and petty. At least they've been done on the job. I think what is difficult for the BBC is that after a series of scandals over the past year, this is just another issue that some of the BBC's supporters will disagree with their approach on this. So I think they're going to lose, you know, a bit of credibility. Some license fee payers are going to be upset. Probably a larger number will take it on the chin. But the BBC is engaged in a very big fight with the government at the moment over the license fee and whether it should have the rights to use all the license fee money on its own or whether it should share it with other broadcasters. The government wants to share it out. The BBC doesn't. But with these sorts of incidents rearing their head, it makes it a lot more difficult for the BBC to maintain support.
The Media Guardian's Stephen Brook. Finally, we meet two of Mexico's best-known film stars, Gael García Bernal and Diego Luna. The pair first appeared together in the well-received Y Tu Mama También, and now, 8 years later, and international stardom under their belts, they're collaborating on a new film, Rudo y Cursi. The story focuses on two half-brothers who leave their jobs on a banana plantation in rural Mexico to chase fame and fortune on the football pitch. This isn't a football movie, but a story of sibling rivalry, poverty, addiction, and economic exploitation. The Observer's film critic Jason Solomons met the pair and started by asking them about their on-screen reunion.
It was 7 years after, and a lot happened, you know. We grow, we're different, we're mature.
Now, well, I don't know about mature, we're more mature.
Yeah, we are like, we're wiser, you know. Mm. Now you can listen to us, in fact, without laughing. You shouldn't laugh. Yeah, no? That's a smile, right? Yeah. Not a laugh. Okay. And we got together again with Alfonso and Carlos, you know, the Cuarón brothers. Carlos directed this film. He wrote Y Tu Mama También. So it's kind of the same team, family reunion kind of thing.
Nice to be back in, because you've been, particularly both of you, have been all over the world, shooting here, filming in the States, directing your own movies. Was it nice to be back where it all began for you, Gael?
It feels like going back home, but in a much more, when things have changed, you know? Things have changed a lot. Everyone's been sort of experimenting on their own, different places, different ways of work, with different directors, with different crews altogether, different stories. So it's not as coming back home. It's like something different. It becomes a new thing, but with the people that you started off working with.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's still a story of journeys in Mexico. There's still a similarity between Y Tu Mama También and Rudo y Cursi. There's a journey from innocence to experience for your characters again, this time, Diego.
And also, I mean, there's a lot in common, I think, basically because the writer is the same guy, you know. But the film has many layers, you know. It's like, and Y Tu Mama También had that, you know. You could have go deeper and deeper and always find something. And this film has the same, you know. At the beginning, you can feel you're just watching a film that is gonna make you feel good, and you're gonna laugh a little bit and get sad probably at the end, and that's it. But then if you keep going, I mean, there is a portrait of Mexico today, you know, or a little piece of Mexico. Yeah. And what I like and love from the film and from what Carlos writes is the humor he finds everywhere, you know, and the way he finds the way to laugh, you know, about really sad issues, you know.
The Observer's film critic Jason Solomons talking to Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna. That's it for today's podcast. Producing today, Senor Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran, back on Monday. Thank you for listening.